We are going to be talking about intervention today. My name is Robert Farley. I am an assistant professor at the Patterson School of Diplomacy and International Commerce at the University of Kentucky. And with me is Daniel Larrison of The American Conservative, also the author of the blog Eunomia. How are you doing today, Daniel?
Doing just fine, Rob. How are you?
I'm good. Now, where are you located?
Right now, I'm based in Chicago. My wife is still finishing her PhD here, and I finished mine a couple of years ago. And so we're still here in Hyde Park.
Oh, cool. Have you been having the thunderstorm issues there, or has that passed you by?
I'm sorry?
The thunderstorm issues, the tornadoes and so forth?
Oh, right. Fortunately, we weren't too bothered by the rainstorm. We did have one big storm over the weekend, but for the most part, we were in pretty good shape.
Right. Well, just to alert you and other Blogging Heads viewers, Kentucky has been under a series of tornado watches and tornado warnings all morning.
So it is
entirely possible that Blogging Heads viewers will watch me sucked to my grisly death outside of my fourth floor window.
Let's hope not.
Well, yeah, and I'm not sure exactly how the logic of that would work, since somehow the computer would have to survive and somebody would have to upload the file. but nevertheless, if that happens, then tell my wife that I love her. She doesn't really watch Blogging Heads, so otherwise I don't think she'd know.
Okay.
And so forth. But yes, so the power may go out here. I have backup battery power, so it's not that big of a deal. But anyway, So today we are going to be talking a little bit about intervention. We may talk a little bit about the international community to the extent that it exists, or international society to the extent that that's a construct that makes any sense either. I think the big issues right now are the ongoing situations in Libya and Syria. And you've written pretty extensively on especially Libya, maybe a little bit less on Syria, but you know, obviously attention is being focused on Syria now. So
right.
Maybe you could just give us some of your initial thoughts on the differences, the frustrations, and so forth of what's going on right now.
Sure. When the talk about intervening in Libya first started, I was encouraged by what I was hearing from people in the administration that they weren't interested in taking military action, that they saw it as not in the American interest and not being particularly productive or helpful. And there was a dramatic turnaround as Gaddafi's forces came closer to Benghazi, and the administration turned, I think as Josh Rogan said, on a dime and decided to intervene. And since then, I've been very critical of what I've been seeing in terms of the decision-making and the gradual creep towards a war for regime change, even though they're not going to call it that because they feel that they're under political constraints not to call it that. But that's clearly where they're headed. And I think that should give pause not only to people who are against these kinds of interventions in general, but to those who value the principle of intervening to prevent large-scale loss of life, to prevent real mass atrocities, when that principle is being taken and used in a debatable case where it's really on the borderline whether it should be falling under this idea of the responsibility to protect. And so I see it as a case where this idea or this principle is being used as a sort of a pretext or a way to open the door to armed intervention. And at the same time that it's doing that, there's a very clear reluctance on the part of the administration to make this into a kind of guiding principle or part of a larger strategy. Mm-hmm. I think one of the things that they went out of their way to say when the intervention began is that the conditions are so special and so unique to Libya that we can't possibly imagine doing this in any other situation. And sure enough, within weeks of their saying that, Syria presents almost exactly the same situation. In some ways, an even more, possibly a more clear-cut situation where you have protesters who aren't armed, who aren't engaged in a direct uprising in the way that the Libyan protests became. and
it became a civil war, an armed civil war on both sides very quickly in Libya.
Right, right. And it was also less clear-cut in Libya when you had most of the centers of resistance being traditional centers of resistance to Gaddafi, places that had decades-long hostility towards him. Whereas in Syria, there seems to be a much more, I don't know if I want to call it broad-based, but a much more peaceful political protest that's then just being met with brute force. And, I mean, of course, that is how things began in Libya as well, but the way that it's evolved in Libya makes it much less clear-cut of a case of straight-up regime violence against peaceful protesters.
Right, right.
And so yes.
Okay, go ahead.
So I was just going to finish the point to say, because there was this clear reluctance to make this into a general principle or a guiding principle of what the U.S. was going to do in the future, that any of the potential deterrent effects or setting an example for other authoritarian governments that Libya might have accomplished were wiped away immediately. And obviously Assad doesn't take seriously the possibility that anyone's going to try to prevent him from doing whatever he wants.
You know, I mean, in classic blogging heads fashion, I have to agree with almost everything that you just said. the frustrations that I've had have been... We'll go through them point by point because I'm interested in sort of your reaction. As you point out, there has been a lot of conversation now about what exactly would have happened in Benghazi, right? I mean, essentially, the West intervened in this case, and NATO intervened in this case, to prevent imaginary deaths, right? I mean, people who might have been killed, but right. When we think about, I've seen people on the internet talk about the massacre in Benghazi, which of course never happened. And of course, a massacre that you stop never happens, and so... You don't get to talk about how the horrors of the massacre in Benghazi that you stopped. But nevertheless, and a lot of people have pointed this out, Stephen Walt has pointed this out, Alan Cooperman has pointed this out, there are serious questions about what actually would have been happening in Benghazi. How exactly the Libyan state was going to treat these captured areas of resistance. And I think there's been a fairly rigorous debate about that, and there have been good points brought up on both sides. But there seemed to be an almost almost breezy assumption that Gaddafi was going to enter these cities and massacre hundreds of thousands of people, as if that's an easy thing to do, as if that's something that regimes like and enjoy doing. Even authoritarian regimes.
I think, especially in the case of Benghazi, the argument that was going to happen is a bit undermined by the fact that Benghazi has rebelled against Gaddafi in the past, and while he's certainly cracked down very brutally on those rebellions, and he has taken away hundreds of people and had them killed in prison, and obviously that's atrocious, that's not what we were being told was about to happen.
Right. It's unclear that rises to the level that would invoke the right to protect, right? In part because we have a very hazy understanding of what the right to protect is, but...
Right, and yes, and there's significant disagreement over whether it should be only in those really exceptional cases where something on the scale of Rwanda seems to be in the making, or when it's something on a lower level, which is still filled with atrocities and horrible acts of violence, but doesn't rise to that sort of systematic killing.
Right.
And so it's I can understand that there will be reasonable people taking positions either way on that. What I think you were getting at is the remarkable certainty that people had that this was absolutely what was going to happen, and failure to act would have been on par with standing by and letting another Rwanda happen.
Right, right. And I think that there was also, and this especially came as the siege of Misrata has continued, there was a lot of conceptual slippage about this, I guess it's the responsibility to protect, about is this something that applies when a regime is about to massacre a bunch of people? Or is this something that applies when, say, we have a civil war, and one side in the civil war is about to win, but you have to conduct nasty, brutal urban warfare in order to win? And that nasty, brutal warfare, urban warfare, is going to cause a lot of civilian casualties. And so this is why there's been so much talk about the various munitions that Gaddafi's forces have used in Misrata and so forth. And people have, have said, here, look at what things would have looked like. But there does seem to be some slippage about whether the responsibility to protect is only in these cases where you have a relatively defenseless civilian population that's about to be massacred, or whether in the conduct of normal military operations, civilians are going to die. And if the responsibility to protect is invoked in this latter case, then the implications are enormous, right? I mean, then almost in any war in the modern world, you could invoke a responsibility to protect, because almost all of them involve urban fighting in some sense. In almost all of these cases, the urban fighting is going to result in civilian casualties. And I think, unfortunately, in Libya, just as the battle has gone on, because we're sort of dealing with what this massacre that didn't happen in Benghazi, people are starting to refer to the casualties that are happening in urban fighting as a justification for Western intervention, when really this is the consequence of a civil war, what would be the end of the civil war, and what will almost certainly be the end of the civil war if the rebels seize Tripoli. I mean, the rebels will have to fight their way through Gaddafi loyalist places in Sirte and Tripoli and so forth. And those battles are likely to be very dangerous to civilians in those areas.
Sure.
Well, and there's been so little thought given to that.
No, that's right. And I think, and you see along some of these coastal towns or highway towns that are part of the battle zone, the civilian populations have been completely displaced at this point. Because, of course, these are the towns that have been changing hands back and forth for the last couple of months. And so the Ajdabiya, for example, has no more civilians in it. They've either fled to Benghazi or they're living out in the desert in some cases. And so in terms of protecting civilians, it becomes much hazier about whether prolonging the conflict and contributing to that ongoing displacement of people inside Libya is really the best thing for protecting civilian life. Mm-hmm. And you were talking about Misrata, and of course there is indiscriminate shelling and indiscriminate artillery fire on the people in Misrata, and that is a deplorable tactic, but it's also one of these tactics that is a result of the relatively low sophistication of Gaddafi's forces and the kinds of weapons that they have at their disposal. Mm-hmm. And I think Nicholas Pelham had an important report in the new New York Review of Books issue, I think it's this forthcoming issue, where he was talking about this kind of urban warfare with indiscriminate shelling being what would have happened to Benghazi, and that would have been, and he describes that as a bloodbath, and I suppose what we're seeing in Misrata would be the same kind of thing that might have happened there. But that, again, that's not the same thing as when everyone was first talking about this. They were talking about a new Srebrenica the assumption that this was going to be a deliberate massacre of people after hostilities had ended. When in fact, it seems like what we're seeing is centers of rebel resistance becoming new Sarajevos, and we can feel sympathy or compassion for the people who are caught in a city that's under siege, but besieged cities are, as you say, part of warfare. And so that it seems to me that at this point, what makes the most sense for those interested in protecting civilian lives is to try to find a way to bring the fighting to an end through some sort of negotiated settlement or ceasefire to at least provide temporary relief to that population and possibly evacuate as many of them as possible. And obviously, the African Union, somewhat less credibly, Turkey possibly more credibly, have been involved in proposing mediation efforts and ceasefires. And what's been, I think, revealing or perhaps disturbing is that the Western governments involved in these interventions have rejected these offers almost out of hand.
Right. In fact, have been increasingly have fallen in behind the idea of regime change as the effective goal of the war. Am I wrong in saying that either Turkey's prime minister or Turkey's foreign minister said yesterday that regime change was now essentially Turkey's goal as well?
Oh, did they say that? I haven't seen that.
I could be wrong. I mean, it's one of these dozens of reports that sort of float by every day in my Google Reader file. But if we could go back a second,
sure.
were suggesting, and one of the curious things for me is that I still can't quite figure out the politics of this, at least from the
okay.
American point of view.
Right.
You suggested earlier that responsibility to protect had been, and I think you used the word pretext, which I think other people have also used. I guess from my point of view, especially for the United States, and I agree with you that the Obama administration seemed very reluctant at the beginning to get involved in this. It really did seem like they were going to stay out of the war. My interpretation was that they were effectively dragged in by France and the United Kingdom, which had a much more much closer interest and much more vigorous interest in actually settling the dispute in Libya. But we can disagree about that, and I think people will argue about that for a long time. But a pretext assumes that there's some reason behind the reason. What I've never really been able to work out is exactly what that reason behind the reason is in this case. I mean, what are we really getting out of regime change in Libya? Other than, in general, Gaddafi's like a bad guy. But it's not as if he's been a terrible guy for the last 6 or 7 years.
Sure.
It's not that much of a problem. So, I mean, what are your
right.
thoughts on sort of the reasoning behind the reasoning?
It seems to me that what seems to have pushed a lot of people into the interventionist camp on Libya is that it's not just a case of humanitarian intervention, but that there is supposed to be a sort of political signal or a political shift on the part of the United States, where by intervening in Libya, we're demonstrating that we are now taking the side of popular causes against authoritarian governments. And so in some ways, the motivation is similar or at least comparable to the one that seems to be responsible for French interest in this conflict,
mm-hmm.
And that is to try to remake the image of the government from one that has traditionally supported autocratic or authoritarian regimes to one that's going to try very actively to undermine or defeat such a regime. And so I would agree that the people inside the administration or inside the White House who were advocating for intervention were making arguments based on the responsibility to protect, and obviously Samantha Power, who's come in for a lot of criticism since the decision, is very much interested in humanitarian intervention in its own right, as a good in itself.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what finally tipped the balance, I mean, and obviously this is all speculation to some point, but what tipped the balance for the president, as far as I can tell, is that there was this belief that there was an opportunity for the United States to act in a way that served its interests and its values at the same time. Obviously, I don't share that reading on the interest side, and I'm not even sure that the values side makes sense either, but I think that's, if there was a larger goal or a concealed goal behind the rhetoric of responsibility to protect, I think that's what it probably was.
Uh-huh. Right, and so, I mean, I guess, do you think that, I mean, I agree with you in the context of the United States. You suggested, I mean, do you think the French and British goals are essentially the same? I mean, or do you think that this is, do you think for France that this is more than just sort of getting on the right side of freedom and so forth, but is restoring an element of sort of French regional supremacy in the Mediterranean or something along those lines? Do you interpret it along those lines? That you think that Paris is thinking sort of along those lines, or sort of a pride of place among Western nations, or some other kind of logic from Paris?
One thing that does seem to be happening with the French, I mean, aside from Sarkozy's own ambitions, which are, that's a separate question, what they seem to be wanting to do is to repair or change the way that France is seen in Africa, moving away from this France-Afrique idea of propping up convenient rulers when they serve French interests, and moving to a more impartial or seemingly impartial position where they're going to be willing to turn against autocratic rulers and support popular insurgencies against those rulers. And so I think there is an interest in trying to rebuild France's image or to change France's image in Africa. But I think much of what they've done over the last, even just the last decade in the rest of Africa, tends to run contrary to that, in terms of what they've done in the Central African Republic and elsewhere in Francophone Africa. I think there will be tremendous skepticism that they're doing any of these things for any reason other than the traditional pursuit of French interests as they had done in previous decades. But I think there's certainly a desire to make things look different than they have looked. When Sarkozy was running I believe it was 2007, one of the things he wanted to do to distinguish himself from the previous Gaullist government under Chirac was to say that he was going to take a much stronger line on human rights and democracy overseas. And certainly that seemed to be confirmed when he appointed Bernard Kouchner to be the foreign minister at the beginning of his term. So I'm skeptical about the extent to which there really is an idealist inside Sarkozy, but I think he wants to project that image, and that's a very significant part of what's driving him. In the case of Britain, I'm not sure really what the idea is, except that, of course, David Cameron and William Hague are both traditionally not opposed to military interventions. Both of them, when they were in the opposition, supported the war in Iraq, and so they're probably much more likely to be in favor of these sorts of things in general. My guess I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, I mean, you sort of suggested, and again, I think this is right, that what we have here is a French play for influence in Africa. I'm wondering if there isn't also intra-European politics going on, where France and the United Kingdom are, to some extent, cooperating, but also to some extent competing for the perception of being the leader of Europe on defense issues, sort of the go-to guy for a European defense perspective, which might do something to explain why the United Kingdom was willing to, and I don't want to blame. I don't want to accord all the responsibility for this to Paris. And I mean, it sort of may seem
right.
Sound like I'm doing this. Although, I mean, certainly, I think that you had the most interest in intervention coming out of Paris from an early period. But that in some sense, maybe the British didn't want to be left behind on what was sort of a major European defense issue and what would be sort of a key event in the ongoing construction of a European defense identity or something along those lines.
Yes, I think there's an element of competition in that each one would like to be seen as leading the way, but it's also, I think, a product of this revived idea of specifically Anglo-French military cooperation that they had just been talking about in the last year, and this presented a sort of a test case for taking that military cooperation out and putting it to use. I think something else that may have been influencing their calculations is that there is a concern underscored by Germany's very clear opposition to all of this, that unless European governments are willing to actually take the lead on military action, there is no credibility behind the idea of any sort of common European military organization or or action in the future. One reason that I'm a little bit skeptical about that is that launching a war or entering into someone else's civil war where the European defense interests are not very clear, it seems like an awfully lousy way to talk about or to promote a policy of European common defense. And it seems to me that's why you have such strong resistance, or at least maybe indifference is a better word in some cases, from a lot of the Central and Eastern European countries that see all of this as a distraction away from the security interests that ought to be concerning Europe.
Right. Now, I wonder, because you suggested earlier that the outcome we should be looking for in Libya is what I think would amount to effectively a de facto partition arrangement. I mean, I don't see how you could bring together the rebels and Gaddafi in some sort of unity government. I mean, I think that if we're looking at an outcome of this, which is not the overwhelming victory of either side, it's partition, right? I don't think it's power sharing.
Right.
Now, what about the argument that the intervention itself has made the death of Gaddafi's regime a key European security interest? That if Gaddafi's regime survives now, even a sort of a rump state that only controls half of Libya, that is disastrous for European security interests, not simply because it demonstrates, say, a lack of will or a lack of capability, but because this rump Gaddafi regime, with all of the ties that have been built up over the past 10 years, severed effectively, with all of the goodwill that's been built up over the last decade, severed, that you might see a return to the sort of terrorism that Gaddafi supported in the 1980s and 1990s against European targets, and other sorts of interference that Gaddafi could carry out against Europe. That because of the possibility of that happening, that even though this wasn't a key European security interest when the war started, that now it is. Now it would be a disaster for everybody in Europe if Gaddafi survived.
That once this sort of thing begins, it sort of takes on its own logic, and there is a strong argument, I think, for what you just said, that now that they have hit the hornet's nest, so to speak, they really can't just walk away and leave things as they are, or as they might turn out to be with Gaddafi still in control of some of his resources or some of his weapons or his ability to direct terrorist attacks against other countries. The potential for that was one of the good arguments, I thought, against taking action, because unless you're willing to really see it through all the way, you're going to be creating this standoff with someone who does have a history of targeting people in other countries for these sorts of terrorist attacks. Mm-hmm. So yes, I think now that it has begun, now that several European governments are committed, I believe the Italians have just agreed to start bombing targets inside Libya after a lot of foot dragging, they have really forced themselves to follow through on that, because as you say, the consequences of stopping halfway would be very serious for them, particularly for those countries that are at the front line or most actively involved in bombing Libya.
We started this off, we were going to talk about Syria as well, and we talked
right.
a little bit about Syria. I guess to start off with, do you see any prospect of any kind of international intervention in Syria? Which is not to say, do you think it's a good idea? Because I think you don't think it's a good idea. I don't think it's a good idea.
Right. Right.
Do you think anybody thinks it's a good idea to intervene in Syria in support of protesters or in support of what may in the future? Because apparently, I mean, one of the precedents we've set here, to go and talk about two things. The lesson that we were supposed to be teaching here when we intervened against Gaddafi was that autocrats would not be permitted to massacre their people. This is not the lesson that autocrats have learned. The lesson that autocrats have learned has been to not talk about how they're going to go and massacre their people, or to do so in as quick and efficient way as possible. But it's obvious that the lesson we were trying to teach has not been learned. And the second... Okay, what was my second point? I can't remember. But anyway, the second precedent is that you don't have to be peaceful protesters in order to incur Western intervention. The situation in Libya descended into a civil war, and a clear civil war with defectors from the army on both sides, with both sides armed, in many cases not heavily armed on either side. Do you see in Syria any kind of intervention, or do you see an escalation of the fighting? What are your thoughts on the future of Syria?
I don't see much prospect for international intervention in the way that we had it in Libya. I suppose it's possible, at least it's conceivable that politically there might be some governments that have chosen to intervene in Libya that would want to intervene in Syria. What I think they're going to run up against is simply the lack of capability to do so, especially if the U.S. is not interested in filling the gaps that are left by relatively limited resources that European governments have. So just the other day, I think Robert Gates, when meeting with the British Defense Secretary, made a point of saying that there is a limit to what we can do, and essentially Libya was the last thing we're going to be adding on to our list of things to do. There's not going to be anything beyond that. And so they basically, that sounds to me like the U.S. military was willing to tolerate this, provided that they didn't have to do as much of it as they've done in the past. But they're not going to accept another mission, especially when it seems like an even more difficult mission than the one that they're doing in Libya. So I think there might be some interest among some of the intervening governments to move in that direction, but they simply don't have the wherewithal, and certainly in terms of regional support or UN approval, they're never going to get that.
You would have to have an extremely motivated Turkey. I mean, the only way I would see it would be a Turkey that is extremely motivated to intervene in Syria, and there's no indication that Turkey has even the slightest interest in intervening in Syria.
That's right, and this all comes out of Turkey's new foreign policy, or the foreign policy they've been cultivating over the last several years, of promoting an idea of zero problems with their neighbors, both East and West. And, of course, this policy has come under great criticism in the West because it's seen as being essentially Islamic or Oriental in orientation, and therefore somehow non-Western or anti-Western. But in terms
right,
of...
Right, right. And it's come under criticism in Israel for... people have sort of pointed out that many of the countries that are around Turkey, that Turkey is cultivating no problems with, are countries that Israel has problems with. And so,
yes, absolutely, yes.
Certainly, Turkey has come under vicious criticism in Israel for vague friendliness to Iran and Syria and so forth.
Right, and so, yeah, so in connection with Syria, I think the Erdogan government is going to be very much interested in trying to keep Assad where he is, to keep a known quantity in power, because this is the government that they have been reconciling with over the last decade. And there's really no incentive for them to stir up trouble there, since more than likely they're going to have to cope with part of any refugee problem that civil unrest or civil violence would create. And they also have longstanding concerns about Kurds living outside of Turkey stoking tensions within Kurdistan against Ankara. And so Turkey would be the one best positioned to take action and probably the one that would have would be perceived as having the most legitimacy to take action by other governments in the region. And as you say, there's basically no chance of that.
Right, right, right. They'd have the least interest in taking action.
Right.
And so the people of Syria will be left to their own devices.
Yes. Well, it would seem so, and that really raises the question of how much. Obviously, Assad didn't learn any lessons from what was going on in Libya, but I have to wonder if there were protesters in Syria who might have been inspired to stand up to the Assad regime on the mistaken impression that if enough of them were killed, we would do something about it.
And right, right. Intervention creates a moral hazard, right, where people who are unprepared to undertake a revolution think that even the early steps of a revolution are going to incur Western intervention. So I think that's absolutely correct.
It's worrisome if the Libyan intervention, whether it makes sense or not, inspires a lot of hopeless or failed uprisings that never stood a chance of success and which we had no intention of helping, as we broadcast very clearly. And it seems to me that that's probably one of the most questionable decisions following the decision to intervene in Libya, and that's the announcement, essentially, that we have no intention of making this into a precedent. If you might at least want to practice some kind of ambiguity about that and say, this could apply in other situations, so don't bet on our unwillingness to intervene elsewhere.
Right.
At least that way you might be able to reap some sort of benefit out of what I still think is a misguided military action, but to say we're basically never going to do this again, it simply confirms that view I think a columnist for the Financial Times described a few weeks ago, that this is really the last hurrah of humanitarian intervention. It's not the beginning of a new norm or a new era. It's essentially this is the last gasp of Western powers demonstrating that they're going to take some action in the internal affairs of other countries, but that they're really only going to do it when there is virtually no cost to them, and they're only going to do it in states that have no patrons and where there's no danger of anything really important being at stake. And so it seems to me that it's going to hollow out that principle as much as it's going to strengthen it.
Right. I mean, I think again that is. It's hard to say. I mean, I guess that I was surprised that things went as far as they did in Libya.
Right.
And so that means I could be surprised in the future when it seems unlikely that there's going to be Western intervention. And so to say that I don't think there's going to be any Western intervention, or that this is the end of Western intervention, I think there were a lot of good reasons to say that the last intervention was the last Western intervention. Let me move this into sort of more general territory. And this gets us into some grand strategic questions, I'm not sure exactly how you categorize yourself, whether you use the phrase offshore balancer or whatever else. I mean, I'm not sure even how much all of those labels and so forth make sense without the sort of an individual description of what exactly every person thinks. But how would you have felt, I mean, how much of your uneasiness with this Libya intervention is because the United States is involved and you don't want your country involved in another war, and how much is that this intervention simply has a whole set of potentially negative effects? So if France and the United Kingdom had just decided to do this under the rubric of the European Union, hadn't asked for U.S. help, hadn't sort of brought the UN into it, or had acted under the UN but without reference to the United States, and it was simply something that happened under a regional organization without involving American military power, American treasure, and so forth, how would you feel about it? Because I know, like, neoconservatives, and you can see sort of how neoconservatives are thinking about this and how John McCain is thinking about it, are appalled that
right.
the United States is standing back as even as much as it is, right? The United States needs to be at the lead of these kinds of operations. And obviously that's not a view I share. But, I mean, I'm curious about how you would feel about this if the United States wasn't involved.
Well, I mean, on the one hand, I would feel better in that the U.S. wouldn't be committed to following through on this initial action with any of the possible future escalations that might have to be undertaken to finish it off. So I would certainly feel better about it if I didn't think that the U.S. was going to be somehow obliged to help conclude the war or to help rebuild Libya afterwards. And I should add, I mean, one of the things that I do find curious about this, the whole approach to the Libyan civil war by the intervening governments, is that essentially they're willing to say, we have a responsibility to protect, but we're not interested in the rebuilding, which is
right.
technically supposed to be the follow-up to the protection. Essentially, we're going to help you get rid of Gaddafi, and then we'll leave you to your own devices, whatever that may mean.
Right.
And so that, anyway, that's another question that I have. But go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, just to add on to that one little point, it is becoming appallingly clear that the rebels have exceedingly little coercive capacity and exceedingly little administrative capacity. And so even
right.
if you're going to hand them a state, you know, they're going to have problems beyond Gaddafi being gone. And
sure.
as you point out, we have basically explicitly said, we're not going to help them with these problems that they're going to have as soon as Gaddafi's gone. But anyway, I digress. You go ahead.
Right. So to come back to the original question, I would feel somewhat better if America weren't connected to this, but it still seems misguided to me, whether it's an exercise in burden sharing or if it's supposed to be a primarily or solely European mission, because I don't see how intervention in someone else's civil war, especially in this kind of half-hearted way, is supposed to either protect Libyans or preserve international peace and security or really even serve European security interests, because the longer that this drags on, the more of a refugee problem it's going to create, the more potential for destabilizing other currently relatively stable governments in the region there will be, and the greater the possibility for neighboring nations to become more directly involved in the fighting, sort of on par with what you saw in the Congolese wars back in the late 90s and early part of the last decade, where it essentially becomes a free-for-all for all of the governments in the region to try to exert some kind of influence in the power vacuum that's being created.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think Europeans, because they are relatively, they're going to be more directly affected by any of the consequences of this war, that they really have an interest in escalating or stoking the conflict. And so that's why, from their perspective, it makes even less sense, really, to have escalated it as much as they have. And so I think I would still find it be a really terrible decision, even if Americans weren't committed to the fight, however minimally or reluctantly.
Right. Right. Yeah, I mean, again, I concur. I mean, I find it altogether curious. I just find it very curious the way that all of this has played out. And I would never say that I was optimistic about this. You know, I
right.
wrote some posts at the beginning of the conflict in which I was, you know, I was very explicit. I hope it all works out. You know, I hope that this works wonderfully. I hope that the
sure.
rebels are competent, and I hope that they don't massacre prisoners. And
you
referred to that. You linked to that one Cole post about Misrata, where,
mm-hmm.
And I think you highlighted the same section that I highlighted, and I think just did over Twitter, but where he talks about how the Gaddafi forces are so demoralized, but they're afraid of surrendering because they're afraid they're going to be summarily executed by the rebels.
Right.
And then he follows that up by saying, and so the rebels need a little bit better in terms of their public relations. And also they need to demonstrate that they won't slaughter prisoners, because that's what they've been doing so far. And they've done this on several cases where they've massacred prisoners that they've taken from Gaddafi's loyalist forces, which are a series of things which a lot of people were saying, this could happen. This responsibility to protect could very shortly be a responsibility to protect rump Gaddafi loyalists from the rebels that we're supporting. And it just, this has just played out so tightly to my worst expectations of how this war would turn out. And I say that knowing that tomorrow Gaddafi may decide, that's it, I'm going home, or a bomb may catch him, or somebody in the circle may shoot him, and that would be great, and everything will be happy and hunky-dory. Maybe that'll happen. I hope that'll happen. But it just seemed to be so telegraphed from the very beginning for a set of just not happy things to happen in this conflict.
Sure. As deplorable as the way that both sides are treating prisoners and detainees and civilians, I think in the one highway town of Bin Jawad, the locals were opposed to the rebels, and so the rebels have started hunting them, or they were when they were in that town, and were attacking them in much the same way that people feared that civilians in the east were going to be attacked by Gaddafi's forces. And that all of that's deplorable, but it's also something that's unfortunately very common in these kinds of civil wars. And you saw in Ivory Coast the way that both armed militias were carrying out atrocities against the civilian population and against each other, and all of that, because Gbagbo has been deposed, all of that's been sort of covered over, and we talk about how the forces of democracy have triumphed or something, but there does seem to be a much greater tolerance for crimes against humanity or war crimes when it's being done by the ostensibly liberating or pro-democracy side. And I say ostensibly because, aside from saying some of the right things on the website of the Benghazi National Council, there's not really any particular reason to believe that regime defectors and people from eastern Libya who have been ground under Gaddafi's boot for decades have any particular commitment to any sort of values that would be recognizably democratic. And which is not their fault, obviously. It's not meant to say that somehow they could have had them and they chose not to. It's simply an impossible situation for them, where they're being, on the one hand, they're being expected to live up to this standard as our standard bearers, as pro-democracy fighters, when of course they're engaged in a war of reprisal against a government that's been brutalizing them for decades. And the idea that was going to somehow turn out with a peaceful or humanitarian ending is not something that I'm easily persuaded of.
I guess what's most shocking to me is that after all this time, there is still what seems to be a profound misunderstanding among Western policymakers. And I don't think it's among Western academics. I think Western academics understand this very well. And I say that as a proud academic. There is still a profound misunderstanding of the authoritarian state. There is still this vision of the authoritarian state as the dictator and his gang of toughs, or the dictator and his family. And that's why there's been so much focus on Gaddafi's family. Right. And not an understanding that every regime, even an authoritarian regime, has a constituency. Every regime, even an authoritarian regime, has an exploited minority or somebody that it's against and so forth. And that there are politics in authoritarian regimes, and that authoritarian regimes have supporters.
Sure.
And this has just, Libya and Syria and Egypt and all of these others have just played out so much as if it's just the dictator and his family or his inner circle and so forth against everyone. But that's not a plausible description of politics in authoritarian countries. It's never been a plausible description of those kinds of politics, and so it's always more messy when you are attempting to depose a dictator, an authoritarian leader.
Sure, and it makes sense that, especially if a regime has been in power for a long time, it's going to co-opt people, especially people who have stakes in the economy, who have some of the incentives to collaborate with the regime in order either to do business or to get ahead, and the regimes create those incentives to try to tie people to it and to keep at least a portion of the population on their side. Right. And that's one of the reasons, it seems to me that's one of the reasons why some of these authoritarian states go through the sham or the farce of organizing political parties and having rubber stamp parliaments, because then this creates a venue or a forum for their supporters to show off or to be recognized as having importance or status within that country. And so it's a way of dispensing patronage in another way. We mostly see it as an effort at propaganda to mask the authoritarianism, when really it's an effort to exert the control of the authoritarian government.
Right. I mean, this is classic Sam Huntington, right? I mean, in developing societies and so forth. Well, I mean, I'm not sure we have a great entree to it, but I mean, you wanted to return to an earlier war, one in August of 2008, which I don't different but related issues. But there is going to be a movie about the 2008 war, which I was unaware of before you mentioned it to me. The 2008 war between Russia and Georgia. I assume we're talking about the same war here, right? And so I don't know, why don't you talk a little bit about that?
Sure, but yeah, and I hadn't been aware that this was coming out until fairly recently. I think I first started seeing stories about it last year. It seems like it's going to be an interesting production. It's directed by Rennie Harlan, the director, oddly enough, of Die Hard 2. Mm-hmm. I guess that's what he's best known for. And Andy Garcia is one of the better-known American actors who will be involved in, or who was involved in, the making of the movie. He will actually play Mikhail Saakashvili, the president of Georgia. And the main narrative of the story, from what I can gather from the trailer and some of the descriptions I've read, is that it's going to be the story of war photographers traveling through Georgia, or maybe just photojournalists. They may not have been traditionally war photographers, but photojournalists traveling in Georgia who are witnesses to the unfolding of the war as it happens. And then there will be, I guess, intercut storylines involving Saakashvili as he's responding to the unfolding of the war. And so it seems like it's going to be, it was made with the assistance of the Georgian government, and I imagine it's going to take a very sympathetic line on what the Georgian view of the war is. But what I find possibly more encouraging about it is that it seems intended to be a strongly anti-war film, and one that I hope demonstrates the real terrible costs of that war to Georgia and to South Ossetia, and and perhaps bring home to people who do see it that these sorts of conflicts are really quite gruesome and destructive, even though they are only going to be lasting for a few days. The name of the movie is 5 Days of August. I believe that's its current title, just referring to the length of the main hostilities between Russia and Georgia. I think it was originally going to be called Georgia, but then they wanted to alter the name for whatever reason.
Are there any notable actors playing Putin or Medvedev or any of the other Russian roles?
I'm not sure who would be playing those characters. I know that a lot of the cast, which also includes, I think, Val Kilmer, Dean Cain, some actors who are fairly well known in the U.S. They're mostly playing the supporting roles, or they'll be playing the journalists who are traveling around the countryside. I don't know that there will be any perspective other than that of the Americans and the Georgians represented in the movie. What I find encouraging about it, even though I may not entirely agree with the way they're going to portray the war, there will definitely, I hope, be a strong message that these sorts of conflicts are, on the one hand, avoidable and also incredibly damaging to all sides. And that would be something that would be, I think, a valuable message to be coming out of a war movie. Certainly many war movies do convey that message. Sorry about that.
Right. And what's also, and this is sort of an interesting parallel to what we've been talking about in this current conflict, is that while the war over South Ossetia certainly shifted power in the Russian direction, right? That in the end, Russia won the war. They consolidated control over South Ossetia. They consolidated control over Abkhazia, demonstrated that Georgia had few international friends, or at least few international friends who were willing to take risks for them. That it's not as if the war solved the problem, right? I mean, the basic problems that were present at the start of the war are still by and large present at the end of the war, and they are still present today.
Yes.
And so it's a classic example of a war that was fought that simply shifted the balance of the problem without resolving the problem, without resolving the issue.
Right.
Which is, I think, what we're both sort of pointing at is kind of what the situation is right now in Libya and these other places, right? That we are thinking about war, and I think that certainly we talked about war in terms of, and talked about the intervention in Libya in terms of a solution to a problem, and whatever that problem may have been, whether it's Gaddafi or whether it's saving the people of Benghazi or whatever not. But what military action has done so far is simply to change the landscape on which the problem is going to be addressed.
Yes.
Do so in a very violent way, in a destructive way, but not to resolve the basic problem. And I think this will be true even if Gaddafi is in the end removed by French paratroopers or whatever. We too often think about major political decisions as ending in a resolution, and that's not what we're going to have here. It's not going to be tied up in a bow and so forth.
Right. Unfortunately, I mean, one of the things that I was thinking of the stalemate or the standoff that continues in the Caucasus when people started talking about creating some sort of East Libyan protectorate, and I referred to it as our very own South Ossetia, where it becomes this sort of millstone around the neck of whichever governments choose to take on the responsibility of protecting that state. And of course, that the state is not going to develop in any sort of healthy or constructive or sustainable way. It's instead going to become probably a highly corrupt, lawless region that's going to become not only an embarrassment for the state that's supporting it, but an open wound in the region that contributes to regional instability, whatever the patron state may think that it's doing.
Right, a center of crime and potentially terrorism in this part of the world and so forth.
Right, and of course it ends up being the same kind of infringement on the territorial integrity and sovereignty of the state that it's being carved out of. And in a similar sort of way, in a way that no one's really willing to go to bat for Georgia in any meaningful way over these issues. I mean, the U.S. will say that these territories are occupied, but they have no intention of going beyond that. No one's going to pay attention to complaints from Tripoli if the eastern half of the country is simply hived off and made into a protectorate.
Right.
And what I think the example in the Caucasus shows is that this is not a way to bring the conflict to an end, but simply to redirect to make the government that controls the rest of the country to make it really obsessed with regaining those territories even more than it was interested in consolidating its power before then. And I mean, one of the things that's been remarkable over the last few years in Georgia is that the government under Saakashvili has become, if anything, even more adamant that the return of those territories is essential, and that making that its overwhelming priority in everything that it does, so that all other bilateral issues with Russia and really all other issues with other governments center around that. And right. It seems to me that that's not going to be particularly helpful for the development of Georgia as a successful democratic state, and it's not going to encourage any of the sorts of regional cooperation or economic integration that even the Georgian government is talking about promoting. Instead, this is going to become a kind of a permanent fixture on the landscape, and all of the tens of thousands of people displaced or living in these little statelets are going to basically be prisoners of this the standoff for the foreseeable future. And that doesn't seem like a very satisfactory handling of it.
It doesn't seem like a very satisfactory handling, and yet it was, the possibility of this happening was predictable from the get-go in Libya. It was predictable from day one that something like this might happen, given the willingness of the participants to actually undertake the costs of war. Well, I think we're actually done. I think we've run out of time.
Okay.
I mean, I know I have to go and teach, so. Do you have any last word?
Thanks for the conversation. It was great, and I'll talk to you again later.
Okay. Well, thank you. Thank the Blogging Heads viewers who have remained to this point. I mean, I have not yet been killed by a tornado, so that's an upside. I guess we'll talk to you soon.
All right. Thanks, Rob.